Chapter 8. Commodore Tommy's saloon on West 39th Street hunched like a fortress in the ground floor and cellar of a crumbling brick tenement a quarter mile from the pier where Isaac Bell's ferry cast off. Its door was narrow, its windows barred. Like a combination Congress, White House, and War Department, it ruled the West Side slum New Yorkers called Hell's Kitchen. No cop had laid eyes on the inside of it in years. Commodore Tommy Thompson, the saloon's bullet-headed, thick-necked proprietor, was boss of the Gopher Gang. He collected tribute from criminals in the drug trade, prostitution, and gambling, pickpockets and burglars, passed along a portion to bribe the police, and delivered votes to the Democratic political machine. He also dominated the lucrative business of robbing New York Central freight cars, his nickname testifying to a level of success in his field that rivaled railroad tycoon Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt's in his. But that business was about to come to a bloody end, Commodore Tommy suspected, as soon as the railroad got around to organizing a private army to run his train robbers out of New York. So he was planning ahead. Which was why, as Isaac Bell's ferry sped across the Hudson River, Commodore Thompson was shaking hands on a new deal with a couple of queueless Chinese, Americanized high-toned Chinamen who had chopped off the long pigtail worn by their immigrant countrymen. Harry Wing and Louis Lowe were hatchet men for the up-and-coming Hip Sing Tong. They spoke good English, were duded up in snappy suits, and were, Thompson took for granted, deadly behind the mild expressions on their well-scrubbed pusses. He had recognized kindred spirits the instant they approached him. Like his gophers, the Hip Sing profited by controlling the vice rackets with muscle, graft, and discipline. And like Tommy's gophers, the Hip Sing were driving out rivals and getting stronger. The deal they had brought him was irresistible. Tommy Thompson's gopher gang would allow the Chinese gangsters to open opium dens on Manhattan's west side. For half the take, the Commodore would protect the joint, supply the girls, and pay the cops. Harry Wing and Louis Lowe would gain for the Hop Sing Tong white middle-class customers with money to spend, the casual ice cream users afraid to venture into the back alleys of Chinatown. A square deal, as President Teddy Roosevelt would say. Done squarely, Sophie Tucker would sing. The Newark, New Jersey Auto Patrol tried to catch Isaac Bell in a Packard. His 1906 gasoline-powered locomobile race car was painted fire engine red. He had ordered the color from the factory to give slower drivers a better chance of seeing him in time to get out of the way. But the color and the locomobile's thunderous exhaust did tend to draw the attention of the police. Before he reached East Orange, he had left the Newark cops in the dust. In Elizabeth, they came after him on a motorcycle. Bell lost sight of the machine long before Roselle, and now the countryside was opening up. The locomobile had been built for the speedway and held many records. Attaching fenders and lights for street driving had tamed it not at all. In the hands of a man with nerves of steel, a passion for speed, and the reflexes of a cat, the big 16-liter machine cut a fantastic pace on New Jersey's farm roads and blasted through sleepy towns like a meteor. Clad boot to chin in a long linen duster, his eyes shielded by goggles, his head bare so he could hear every nuance of the four-cylinder engine's thunder, Bell worked the shifter, clutch, and horn in relentless tandem, accelerating on straights, sliding through bends, warning farmers, livestock, and slower vehicles that he was coming through. He would have enjoyed himself immensely were he not so worried about John Scully. He had left the lone wolf detective in a lurch. The fact that Scully had fallen into the lurch on his own meant nothing. As case boss, he was responsible for looking after his people. He drove with his big hands low on the spoked steering wheel. When he had to slow in towns, it took both hands to lever the massive beast into turns. But when he poured on the speed on the farm roads, she grew beautifully responsive. One hand was enough, as he repeatedly reached out to pump up the fuel pressure and blow the horn. He rarely touched the brakes. There was little point. The men in Bridgeport, Connecticut, who built the locomobile, had supplied a stopping system that relied on squeezing the chain shafts, a half-hearted afterthought amounting to little more than no brakes at all. Isaac Bell didn't care. As he roared out of Woodbridge, a 120-horsepower Mercedes GP Roadster tried to give him a run for his money. Bell pressed the locomobile's accelerator pedal to the floor and kept the road to himself.